Hello, I'm Sandy Toksvig, and thank you for joining me for the News Quiz Extra, coming from London's Broadcasting House. Now, a typical News Quiz recording lasts for far longer than the tightly edited 28 minutes wafting out of your wireless on a Friday evening or a Saturday lunchtime. And the purpose of the News Quiz Extra is to allow these formerly lost jokes some much-needed room to breathe, much like a fine Stilton or a vintage bottle of Buckfast. On with the show.
We present the News Quiz with your host, Sandy Toksvig.
Hello and welcome to the News Quiz. We start with a cutting from the BBC News website read by Zeb Sones.
A woman has appeared before the Islamic Sharia Council to ask for a divorce because her husband refuses to give her one.
Our thanks to everyone who sent that in. Now let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, Jeremy Hardy and Simon Munnery. And opposite them on my left, John Finnemore and Sue Perkins. Jeremy, who's more interested in wealth than health?
The NHS, which is a beacon of goodness in our country. Hospitals are going to be credit rated by Standard & Poor's. And I just don't care whether they're credit worthy, to be honest. When my doctor says, do you want to go to St. Thomas's, St. George's or King's? I shall say, well, I want to go to the one where they wash their hands and don't leave forceps in my chest cavity. I'm not thinking, well, which one would I most safely lend money to?
You don't want that? Surely I want to know how my hospital's doing on the footsie.
Doctors aren't allowed to play footsie with you.
It crosses
a line.
There's a tribunal you can go to, Sandy, if you've been affected by those issues. Although, I suppose people playing footsie are more likely to touch the top of your head. I don't know.
I'll give an extra point for anybody who can tell me another story that the NHS was involved in this week, because there were several. Simon?
You've got one, Simon?
No.
Any? No? No? No. It's not required.
I don't know much about economics, like all economists.
Yeah, fair point.
We wouldn't be in this mess. What was something else about doctors, pensions?
Yes.
There's some verbs in there as well, but I can't remember what they were.
Did you lose interest? You read pensions and doctors and that was the end of it?
I mean, sometimes I get so depressed by the state of the world and so perplexed by my own inability to do anything about it that I stop reading The Guardian.
One of the stories is that leaflet thing. Leaflets in A&E... have adverts for ambulance-chasing law firms, you know, like...
Have you been in an accident?
Yeah. Can you not walk in a straight line at work? Call Clumsy Direct and we'll send you a cheque.
But if you're lying on a gurney with a neck brace on, the last thing you want, surely, is a leaflet that says, have you been in an accident? Because...
I think it's because the Tories hate health and safety and they've got this thing about compensation culture. The problem is it's compensation culture because everyone's obsessed with health and safety. In the old days, construction workers were glad of the work and a bit of boiling scaffolding falling on their head was a boon. But the Tories hate health and safety because sickness and death are the twin pillars of their ideology, I think.
I mean, there obviously are stories that are absurd about health and safety and where health and safety has been wrongly applied, but that's too much health and safety. And the problem is not in the words health and safety, it's in the words too much. Too much of anything is too much. That's what it means. Not enough health and safety is not enough. What you want is the right amount of health and safety, and then people will be healthy and safe.
You'll be over-healthy.
Do you know, it was like a Liberal Democrat was in the room. The NHS regulator has proposed that hospitals should no longer be assessed on the quality of care they provide, but their financial viability, as rated by Standard & Poor and Moody's. Poor and Moody, it's a recipe for antidepressants. Credit agencies are a great way to regulate and flag up systemic problems, which is why a bank has never gone bust or lost anyone's savings. Fantastic idea. 2 points to Jeremy and an extra one to Simon. Simon, whose maritime plans have sprung a leak?
Ah, this will be Gove. Gove, Michael Gove. And we've got a lot to thank him for.
Yes.
Ant and Dec. And that's Biker Grove, sorry. Always getting those mixed up. He's come up with a lot of ideas over the last month. 4, by my count. So he's an ideas man, but slower. The first time he caught my attention was he's been trying to force Downhills Primary School in Haringey to become an academy.
All right.
And my daughter went there. And I chose Downhills, despite the name, because it doesn't sound that good, does it? Well, you're going downhills. I thought it had a good atmosphere, and I'm not really keen on the whole academy system. It hasn't got a very good record. I mean, they tried it in America. Police Academy was a disaster. And then his second idea was Bibles. Yeah. For the anniversary of the King James Bible, somewhere abroad is a stack of Michael Gove Bibles that he's intending to send to every school, one per school, and he's going to sign them personally, which is nice because it's, you know, the Word of God plus a signature of Michael Gove. And then his latest one is this, which was a leaked letter, that he's, for the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, he wants us, the nation, to provide her with a yacht. You know, Diamond Jubilee, yacht. Which is just wrong, isn't it? It's Diamond Jubilee, diamond. That's how it works. You know, it's not, oh, it's our dinghy anniversary. Oh, congratulations, dear. 20 years, here's your surfboard. No, as far as I'm saying with anniversaries, you know, it's paper, scissors, stone, no. Ruby, diamond, plutonium, I'm not sure.
Is there a plutonium anniversary?
It's the last one.
Yeah, it is.
Let's give you an insight into what it must be like in cabinet meetings, though, with Gove. If they're saying, you know, we're in real trouble, the economy is tanking, but we, you know, I need ideas. If there's any ideas, there's no such thing as a bad idea. Michael, maybe it's time to give the Queen a yacht. It's... There must be a sort of collective sigh. Yes, Mike, no, maybe you're right. No, that's... if the Queen has a yacht, then maybe it's a trickle-down effect. We give her a yacht now, and in 2 years' time, we'll all have a dinghy.
So, did you think it was a good idea for a gift for a...
The Queen?
An 85-year-old woman and her 90-year-old husband with heart problems. A big boat that they can water ski off. I don't know.
The thing is, he's forgetting his history. I mean, she had a yacht. She didn't look after it. We had to take it off her.
I mean, I think we should get her something, but I don't see what's wrong with a moon pig card and some book tokens.
Given that he's in charge of schools, he ought to make her something.
That's
with
some, true.
Make her a card with dry pasta shells stuck on it.
He's retracted it all now, hasn't he? He's sort of said, I didn't mean that, and I meant a few private individuals of means. He's
well,
sort of...
people have been backwards and forwards about this, because there was a wonderful moment when the plan seems to have been endorsed by David Cameron, and the Guardian said he had swung behind the royal yacht, and I thought, oh, I do hope he was attached to a mooring rope.
I'm just worried that whatever we get her now, she'll be disappointed.
Yeah, it's
because she's had this yacht dangled in front of her. Ooh, candlesticks, lovely. Not a yacht.
Why is Gove always sucking up to her? Do you not expect any day to hear a story of him being discovered in the Queen's bedroom late at night?
I think she's got his glasses. He used to have glasses. And I think she bullied him one day, because he's schools minister. She took his glasses off him and said, I got your glasses, you'll have to fight before them go. And he's too weak to fight an 85-year-old woman, but he thinks if he gives her a yacht, she'll give him... I'm guessing, could be that. But...
Michael Gove proposed that taxpayers give the Queen a brand new yacht as a Diamond Jubilee present. On Monday, the cost of the yacht was reported to be £60 million. By Wednesday, it was £80 million, because they had added a subscription to Sky HD. The last royal yacht was decommissioned by Labour after the 1997 election. It wasn't needed because Tony Blair could walk on water. 2 points to Simon. John, who thinks sharing shares is a capital idea?
Oh, well, this is Nick Clegg's day release scheme.
Yeah.
Whereby every couple of months, in return for all the horrible things he does and has done to him, he's allowed to go out in front of the cameras and play at being a Liberal Democrat for the day and stand there and say, look, I am the Deputy Prime Minister, I'm a very important man, with very important opinions, very important hair, and this is what I think we should do. For instance, this time he thinks we should have a John Lewis economy as opposed to the Kodak economy we're enjoying at the moment. And the John Lewis economy apparently is one where workers get to have more ownership of the companies they work for. And it's not a bad idea. Those firms do tend to work well and they are probably fairer to their employees. Doesn't really matter what I think, and certainly doesn't matter what Nick Clegg thinks, because it's not going to happen. It's not really workable when you get into the boring economic nitty-gritty of it. And it's a perfect Liberal Democrat holiday idea. And he's had it, and he said it, and now he can go back, and David can say to him, got it out of your system. Good. Sit back down. We're trying to work out if we sell the NHS to China, can we buy Princess Margaret a hovercraft?
Perfect fit, because John Lewis's motto is never knowingly undersold, which is surely the exact opposite of a Lib Dem manifesto pledge.
never knowingly overwhelmed.
Yes.
This week is the week where they're all trying to talk about moral and immoral capitalism, and Ed is saying, well, they're all just copying me because I raise the idea that sometimes capitalism is bad. And you think, oh, for God's sake, you're the leader of the Labour Party. The idea that capitalism is sometimes bad ought really to be a given, Ed. He said, sometimes people get overcharged for things. This is his big idea, is that sometimes people get overcharged for things. It's like sometimes you cut into a hard-boiled egg and the middle falls out.
Well, interestingly enough, in that speech that Clegg gave, he referenced the 1980s. He referenced share ownership,
right.
Which is a distinctly Tory notion. So he's trying to break out and trying to say something new, but it seems he's been pwned by David
Cameron. He was very careful to point out that it wasn't woolly and liberal at all, it was tough and mean.
Yeah.
And he said that, you know, some people think I'm doing this because it's somehow a nicer idea. No, I'm not. I'm doing it because it's tough. And I think he used the word savvy, that these share-owned partnership companies are as savvy as any other business. Yeah, we're going to be savvy and street like Waitrose.
See, I think I went too far with the John Lewis thing. I forgot about it was the shares thing. I thought, oh, that's what the economy needs, a haberdashery. I just thought it was to have somebody at Dover ready to spray people with a perfume sample as they arrive in the country. I think it's rather nice. I'd like a John Lewis world. Can I help you with something? Yes, I've lost my glasses. Oh, they're under the Radio Times. Thank you so much.
I just like the sound of it. A John Lewis economy. If you didn't like it, you could take it back.
Yeah. Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg. Remember him? Thought not. Wants companies to offer their employees shares, creating a John Lewis economy. John Lewis is owned by its employees, much like the government is owned by the Murdochs. And Michael Gove is owned by the voices in his head. Staff owning shares in their company is a great idea. Just ask the workers at Northern Rock. 2 points to John. Sue, why did the White House spark a blackout?
This is the Wikipedia blackout, the 24 hours where Wikipedia shut down. And in the place of Wikipedia, you just had a sign which said, imagine a world without free knowledge. And in case you couldn't imagine a world without free knowledge, it then supplied a handy link to the Times Online site. So this basically is about internet piracy laws. Currently, they're trying to push through the House of Representatives and the Senate two laws, SOPA and its sexy-ass sister Pippa, which basically are trying to up the stakes to make copyright infringement so expensive to police that it sort of rules out amateurs. It rules out the likes of you and I. The problem is that they've forgotten what the internet is for. The internet is for publishing things, but it's also for sharing stuff. And actually, this is an incredibly cynical piece of legislation. It's trying to put information sharing solely in the hands of those filmmakers or distributors. It basically rules the rest of us out as creative beings. So if I chance upon a picture of a cat that looks like Hitler, what harm is there of dispensing it throughout the known world? And so for 24 hours, we couldn't get Wikipedia, which was terrible for me because it means anybody researching me during that window wouldn't have been able to see that I'm a 53-year-old circus entertainer, former shot putter, who was narrowly beaten by Usain Bolt in the 100 metres in the last Olympics and is currently enjoying a relationship with part-time witch and Tea Party aficionado Michelle Barkman. It's all there, just go online. Yes, it really is the absolute benchmark in academic veracity, Wikipedia. But for all its flaws, it was unavailable. And I know that it's the Radio 4 position to be rather curmudgeonly about technology, but it's the worst thing that could happen to the internet. Basically, if this goes ahead, we will see not only the essential ethics of the internet and the essential sort of founding spirit of the internet destroyed, but also the architecture which allows it to actually be. So there's a potential that the presidential veto might be deployed.
Well, if you want to, all you need to know from a moral point of view is that Rupert Murdoch is in favour.
Internet piracy sounds a bit dull, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
I can't see many films being made like Internet Pirates of the Caribbean. I mean, when you think, you go through all that trouble, you put on a big earring, you pull out some teeth, and then you go online and illegally download the PJ Harvey album.
It's a lot of work.
It's not buccaneering, is it, really?
It's not buccaneering. No. The other horrible thing about it is that companies will be able to just assume that you have pirated something in the exact opposite way that justice has been to
centuries. So you're guilty, you're presumed guilty.
Yes. Exactly, presumed guilty until you can hire lawyers and prove yourself innocent.
I think they should clamp down on film critics who tell you the end.
I had a very only sort of Hollywood experience was that when the film Mamma Mia came out, I was asked to write something about it for the Radio Times, and indeed I went out and met the less than charming ABBA people in Sweden. And
Don't tell me that Benny, Bjorn, Agnetha and the other one aren't charming.
Do you know, I can't even remember the name of the man I met. It was either Bjorn or Benny, but I couldn't remember. Honestly, I can't remember. But
don't you all get on then, you Scandinavians? Don't you just naturally kind of just... Isn't there a kind of herring vibe that just happened?
He was so rich, he'd given his manners to a charity shop. I was told that I was going to be allowed to see 5 minutes of the film, but they were so paranoid about giving it to somebody. A security guard, I'm not joking, a security guard arrived at my house with this DVD, and he stood while I played it. He wouldn't even sit down. Mm. I wouldn't have tea in case I'd have poisoned him or something. And and I played the DVD, and they had done this thing. They had somehow managed to embed my name the way through the whole film. So I was the star of Mamma Mia for a brief while. The online encyclopedia Wikipedia took down its English content on Wednesday in protest at new US anti-piracy laws that it says could severely limit people's access to online information. During the blackout, people were forced to act without checking their facts. And another piece of the Gove jigsaw falls into place. University students had to go back to old-fashioned methods and glue pages of Encyclopedia Britannica into their essays. And at the end of round one, the scores are John and Sue have got 4 points, but Jeremy and Simon have gone into the lead with 5. We start round two with a cutting from the Sheffield Star.
Future of police helicopter up in the air.
And our thanks to Hugh Kelly for sending us that. Jeremy, why is a waking nightmare better than a sound sleep?
Well, this is the theory that you shouldn't sleep on it, on a problem, because what happens is that if you go to bed with any sort of trauma still in your head, it will become embedded by bad dreams. So, you know, if you go to bed thinking about being upstairs on a bus naked for no reason at all, you will have that nightmare, and in the morning you will feel even worse. But then I have that dream anyway. So, but this is all based on the idea of images. They did tests where people were shown horrible things, then went immediately to sleep. And if they went immediately to sleep, then that lodged in their head. Whereas if they were up, you know, didn't go straight to bed, it dissipated. So I suppose it depends who's on question time, really.
So basically you're saying you shouldn't sleep on a problem.
Well, this is one theory. There's another theory that says during rapid eye movement period of sleep, you actually heal. That's what dreams and all that stuff is about. It's a self-cleansing process and you actually feel better. But normally when you wake up, partly I just think, what a horrible dream. I'm glad that wasn't true. And then I think, but on the other hand, I am still me.
You see, you shouldn't go to sleep on a problem. What if your problem is that you have a lumpy mattress?
What if your problem is insomnia?
I looked it up because they talked about harrowing. If you'd seen something harrowing. Did you know the word harrowing comes from harrow, the public school?
Does it? Yes. To do with harrowing a field?
It's some initiation ceremony where I think you have the youngest boy's geometry set shoved up your arse. I don't know how it works.
So that's what it was.
Yeah. Do you not think somewhere right now there's somebody on a Ryanair flight thinking, don't fall asleep, it'll make things worse?
You can't fall asleep on a Ryanair flight. Yeah. Because there's somebody always trying to sell you something. Why would you want to buy an electronic cigarette? Which is what I was woken up for. Would you like an electronic cigarette? It makes a smell and it makes smoke, but it's not really smoke because it's water and it lights up and it's got a blue end. Would you want one? It's only $19.99. Go away.
Thankfully, trains are impossible to sleep on in second class. They're really, really uncomfortable because falling asleep in public is my nightmare. Mm. It's waking up with a long streak of dribble making its way. Finding you're sitting opposite, you know.
It was you! Before Christmas, my mother said she couldn't decide whether or not to have her drive tarmacked, and I said she should sleep on it. She took me literally, honestly. Woke her up, she was hugging a badger. Sleeping after experiencing an unpleasant event does not make memories less painful but more vivid, according to research by the University of Massachusetts. The research could help soldiers with post-traumatic stress and women who've just had sex with Silvio Berlusconi.
That's sleeping under a problem, though, isn't it?
That is. 2 points to Jeremy. Simon, why does the rain in Spain fall mainly on the job centre?
Ah, this is because there have been a massive rise in job seekers seeking elocution lessons.
Yes, there has.
And one explanation is that it's because of employment prospects being a bit tight, and the other explanation is the King's Speech has encouraged people to come out of the woodwork and see if they can get their voices changed. But, I mean, the real reason you won't be able to get a job is there aren't any. Jobs. They speak of jobs as if they existed, don't they? Jobs are coming to the northeast. Run, catch one. I'm unemployed. That sounds quite low, but job seeker. Mm. So it's got a lovely sound to it. Mm. You know, I'm a job seeker. I have an allowance. It sounds. It's really putting a positive spin on it.
They said it was all to do with the King's Speech. They're saying this boom in elocution is because, but that was speech and language therapy. That wasn't elocution. No. King George VI's problem was a severe speech impediment, not the fact that he was a flower girl in Covent Garden Market. I can't say we're at war with Germany. I'm a good girl, I am.
I had elocution lessons. This isn't my real accent. At home, I sound like Sarah Lunn from The Killing. Apparently, did you see that Joan Bakewell is too posh for the BBC?
Oh, yes. She said she was forced to get rid of her accent in the 1960s, and she said that she went into a toilet and came out with a fully-fledged posh accent. I don't want to know what happened in that toilet. And she's now saying that because of political correctness, the BBC are using accents from all over the UK now.
I'm not sure accent is entirely important. I mean, John Major never had elocution lessons. He got to shag Edwina Curry, so I think it's...
God, is that the end game that you aspire to, though?
I went into a toilet once, and
How did you come out speaking?
I'd had an unfortunate bowel movement, which was quite malodorous, and I came out...
Tell us
I'm
more.
Only telling you this because it's true. I came out of the toilet, and Donald Sutherland was standing there, which doesn't normally happen, but there was Donald Sutherland... And all I could think to say was, I'm sorry, I've left a bit of a smell. And he went in, and I'm washing my hands. I was thinking, oh, God, it's Donald Sutherland. I love Don't Look Now. I was like, oh, no, it's Donald Sutherland. And I shouted, is it all right? And he said, it's pretty bad. Have you seen a doctor?
There has been an increase in the number of people changing their accents in order to get ahead at work. More people are getting lessons to speak the Queen's English, as they think it will give them a better chance of receiving a £60 million yacht from the government. The number of people seeking voice coaching has doubled in the last year in response to the depressed jobs market. There's a market for depressed jobs. How awful. At 2 points to Simon. John, why is there a question at the end of the rainbow?
This is the story that most people's parents are stupider than mine. Yeah. Because it's a list of... It's a story which is about they having found out, and by they I mean people, have compiled the 10 questions which most often children baffle adults with when they ask about science. And I looked at the list and I asked all of those, and my dad knew them all, and so now I know them all. It's things like, why is the sky blue? Because God is a boy. And votes conservative. What else is there?
Should I ask some of them? Would that be helpful?
Absolutely.
Okay. How do I do long division?
Badly.
No, it's like normal division, just take your time. What makes a rainbow?
Is it a rain arrow?
The correct answer is the dying breath of children who ask too many questions. Why is water wet?
It's interesting because supermodels say that they never wash their face with water because water's very drying. And I think, yeah, I find that. The money I've wasted on towels.
I saw a bottle of water once with 100% pure hydration written on it.
What?
All of the water in the bottle was water.
Yeah. Wow. Have you got children, Simon?
Yes.
Do you answer these questions for them?
I do my best, but the thing is, they've got inquiring minds, but what they're really inquiring is to your limits of tolerance.
Yeah. I find the best answer to any question by my children is, look, sweets.
Also, there was one about why can you sometimes see the moon during the day, to which I remember asking my dad that, and his answer was, you can't, it never happens, it's impossible. And when I said, what's that? He said, my God! They've come back for you. I knew this day would come. Get in the cellar, don't come out till tea time.
A survey by the Big Bang Science Fair has revealed the top 10 trickiest science and maths questions that children ask, and found that 2/3 of parents were unable to answer them. 80% of parents are stumped by tricky science questions from kids. And if any parents are listening, if you have 5 apples representing parents, 4 of them are bad at science. Magic's quite a good answer. Why is the sky blue? Magic. How do planes fly? Magic. How did George Osborne become Chancellor?
Dark magic.
Yeah.
Dark arts.
2 points to John. Sue, which rocky claim wasn't hollow?
Ah, yes, this is a sort of Secret Service-related question. When you think of Secret Service, you think of James Bond, you think of all this sort of exciting spy stuff. It's become so embedded in our consciousness that it's sort of shameful when you actually look at the truth. And this is the admission this week, that our Secret Service is less sort of 007 and more sort of 00PS. It's really sad. Basically, I think it's Jonathan Powell. He's the ex-chief of staff to Tony Blair's administration. And he's admitted that we spied on the Russians using a rock, a hollowed-out rock. And, of course, the Russians knew that we were doing this. They mentioned this and we denied it, and now they've fessed up. And even they've said, it's a bit embarrassing, isn't it?
It's the rock in a park. I mean, are they just hoping people will walk past and say something interesting? Is that the, is that the sort of general...
I hope he goes near that rock. We'll learn some things if he goes near the rock. Yeah. Or go on, go a bit closer. Oh, he's going away from the rock. You're not going to learn anything unless he goes near the rock.
But you need to have, you know, somebody involved, very, very high up in the KGB, to actually pick up the rock and bellow a secret into it. and for the Brits to go, well, I hope to Jeeves' sake we've pressed play and record at the same time. By the way, absolutely scum.
Why, this magnificent rock. Mr. Putin will love it for his rock collection. In the Kremlin, right in the big room where we make all the secret decisions.
Yes. Oh, I like a good one. I'm not wrestling lions. I like to have a massive paperweight with a big microphone inside it.
If you want to hide something in Russia, surely you put it in a bottle of non-alcoholic beer.
I'm worried the Russians are working on the spy scissors as a counteract.
The Chinese have already got the paper.
Maybe the Russians have planted an inanimate object in this country to damage our national security. Well, you think it's fanciful, but the other option is you got elected Labour leader on merit. Tony Blair's former chief of staff, Jonathan Powell, has admitted that a high-tech spy rock...
Spy rock.
The Russians found in a Moscow park in 2006 had been planted by British Secret Service agents. The spy rock was placed by a tree in a Russian park where it collected enough information to prosecute 2 Russians of spying and 3 of dog fouling.
It's like Conker, but stone.
The story has inspired a new Cold War thriller with Pierce Brosnan expected to play the rock. At the end of round 2, the scores are John and Sue have got 8 points, but Jeremy and Simon remain in the lead with 9. Before we start round 3, here is a cutting from the BBC website.
The Big Question, Episode 2. Nikki Campbell debates evidence for the existence of God in Warrington.
And our thanks to everyone who sent us that. Jeremy, whose new dress code is fascinating...
Ascot. Mm. This is one of those words that you suddenly read and you're supposed to know what it means, and I didn't. Apparently, fascinated. It's one of those weird things that people have sort of stuck. When you see people dressed up for weddings and you think, oh, why do you look like that? You probably look quite sensible in your normal life, but you've just got this coat hanger covered in fur nailed to your head now. But it's called a fascinator, which isn't what... That's not my emotion when I see those things. You know, I don't see those things and think, my goodness, what a fascinating thing. I wonder who made it. But they've banned them because it scares the horses.
Only from the royal enclosure. That's interesting. The public are allowed to wear hats or fascinators, but in the royal enclosure, just hats. Yeah. I think that's wrong. First of all, I like the sound of a royal enclosure, some sort of paddock.
Is this after the Beatrix and Eugenie fascinator debacle, where they appeared with sort of Philip Tracy gynecologically accurate origami explosions off one side of their head?
I think the guidelines for Ascot now are basically a picture of Princess Beatrice with the word don't underneath. Of course, the question then is, when does a fascinator become a hat?
When it's grown up.
Does it have to go through metamorphosis? Does it form a chrysalis first?
I don't ask me. You'd be asking the wrong person. I don't know. I think a hat is a covered crown Whereas a fascinator makes you look like Boris Johnson on a roller coaster. I think that's...
They've banned fascinators at Ascot. Where next? No javelin at the opera.
Royal Ascot has tightened its dress code, outlawing fascinators within the royal enclosure and insisting hemlines fall at or below the knee. From now on, strapless, off-the-shoulder and halter-neck dresses are also not permitted, as they were proving too distracting to the other jockeys. Overseas visitors are allowed to wear their national dress. I always go as a mermaid. 2 points to Jeremy. Simon, listen to this. Simon, who has been voicing their disapproval of modern cinema?
It's audiences in Liverpool, I believe.
Yes.
Some people went to see The Artist, the famously silent film, and complained that it was silent. I've been to see The Artist, and it wasn't silent when I saw it. There was a man snoring loudly behind me. I don't blame him. So a good excuse for sleep, a film.
I was thinking that silent radio never really took off, did it? I mean, you get the early days of film, you get silent film, but silent radio is...
I wouldn't mind if it was a silent version of The Archers. Yeah. That would save me having to turn the radio off.
I like The Artist, though, Simon. Didn't you like it?
I didn't like the character of The Artist.
Didn't you like the dog?
Of course. Aww. I like the dog.
Well, yeah, come on.
But it's slightly unfair, you know, that we laugh at the people in Liverpool who complained that it was silent. But it doesn't mention anywhere on the film poster that it's silent. It says, PG, may contain scene of threat.
Oh.
I don't know what that means, to be honest. A scene of threat.
They do that, don't they? It may contain mild peril, I saw once.
It's true, absolutely mild peril. I haven't seen the Artist, but roughly the same thing happened to me. I was watching Sherlock on Sunday, and it turned out I'd sat on the remote. But I thought, what a marvellous silent film. I was really enjoying it. Cinema goers have been demanding refunds for the French silent film The Artist because it contains no dialogue. L'Artiste est un film romantique français, muet en noir et blanc. Sorry, English Wikipedia was blacked out and I just was trying to help you. 2 points to Simon. John, why are more and more police doing time?
This is a very interesting story, but not for the reason it seems interesting. Because this is a story about how the Metropolitan Police spent £35,000 in the last 2 years calling the speaking clock. Which is pretty extraordinary. I didn't even know it was still going. You wonder how much they're spending on telegrams and passenger pigeons. until you look up the Metropolitan Police on Wikipedia, and there are 30,000 police constables in the Metropolitan Police, and there are 5,000 special constables. So that rather neatly makes 35,000. So they all spent £1 each in the last 2 years on the speaking clock. And that doesn't seem all that much. It still seems like an odd thing to do, but it's not that much to spend. Then you find out, just by reading around a bit, that every time a police officer needs to record something off CCTV footage, he has to, or she has to, check if the timestamp is accurate against an atomic clock, otherwise it's inadmissible as evidence.
No.
Yes. So I imagine what happens is they normally use their phone or their device or whatever, but occasionally they're out of service, and so, you know, once or twice a year, they ring the speaking clock, and it all adds up. So, actually, there is nothing remarkable about this at all. It's just that a journalist has seen an enormous number and gone, oh, they'll find that outrageous and put it on the front page of their paper.
John, I'm afraid you've rather misunderstood the point of the programme. You see, the thing is... is not to find perfectly rational explanations for things, but to assume that all of life is risible and therefore decry it in a rather superior way.
Well, in that case, I don't know what these foolish bobbies think they're playing at, the buffoons.
There is something very odd about it, because they'd say we're committed to reducing costs. It must be remembered, however, that a huge number of our officers and staff will not have direct access to the internet, as they are not office-based. Now, to ring the speaking clock, you need a phone, and I don't know about you, but my phone's got the time on it.
Yeah.
But why would you... I mean, as it gets towards your ear, turn your eyes slightly to the right, you've got the time.
So, even if you haven't got a phone, surely we could invent... If we could put a man on the moon, we could invent some portable device you could wear, I don't know, on your wrist, or...
think it would rather explain the rather poor clear-up rate with serious crime. If it's like, and what do you estimate time of death at? I'd say this one's been dead for about 2 hours. Right, well, what time is it now? We better get back to the station and ring the speaking clock.
They spent £200,000 calling directory inquiries.
I thought they could just get all the numbers they want. I thought if you've got a mate on the force, then you just give them a number plate, and within 4 minutes they say, I don't ask them to do this again. This is the last time. Come on, you owe me. All right. And they ring you back and they tell you who it was.
I was once released by the police for knowing what the time was.
Sorry?
I was released by the police. I was standing outside the paddling pool in Stoke Newington, Clissold Park, staring at the paddling pool, because my children were in the pool, but I was having a cigarette, and I didn't think it was right. You're not allowed to smoke in a paddling pool, it just doesn't look right. And it's very hard to get it to burn. So I was bare feet, smoking a cigarette, and I noticed two policemen. I thought, oh, what are they looking at? Is there trouble inside that paddling pool? So I was looking at it, and the next thing I knew, they'd made a pincer movement, they got me. And they said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I was going to ask you, what are you doing? And they said a bit of a... And I thought, well, this is only going to end one way. So I tried to get my children to wave at me, but they weren't. So I'm waving at this paddling pool, getting no response back, and they're looking at me more and more suspiciously. No shoes, cigarette, staring at a paddling pool, got to be guilty. And then I suddenly thought, I said, do you know what the time is? It's 12:20. And I showed them, but I didn't have a watch. And they checked their watches, and it was. And then they let me go.
It's good to know the safety of our children is being thoroughly investigated in that manner. The Metropolitan Police spent more than £35,000 on 115,000 calls to the speaking clock in the past 2 years. They also spent thousands travelling back and forth to Stonehenge to check what season it is. And millions searching for the body of Christ so they can be sure it's Anno Domini. The Taxpayers' Alliance were outraged at the money spent, with their representative, Matthew Sinclair, declaring, if only someone would have sex with me, I wouldn't get so worked up about these sort of things. Oh, you do hope they listen. 2 points to John. Sue, why is home where the fat, clogged heart is?
Ah, yes, this is to do with the rise and the popularity of food programming, because we're providing this sort of rolling gourmet buffet at home to try and keep up with the Joneses. They're sort of permanently got hands in the fridge at midnight trying to echo Nigella Lawson. Well, oh, should I have the chicken leg or the gatto? I'll have both simultaneously. And we are piling on weight. And this is sort of exemplified by a woman in the States, actually, who's called Paula Deen. Paula Deen is a sort of good old Southern belle who looks like a space hopper and who sort of cooks all good old-fashioned food like butter and peanut butter and cream and ghee and lard and dripping and animal fat and all that kind of stuff. And she made this huge industry out of basically getting people to be enormously fat and has just revealed she's been suffering from type 2 diabetes for years.
I will give a point to anybody who can give her recipe for a brunch burger.
A brunch burger.
Does anybody know what it is?
It's a combination of breakfast and lunch, isn't it?
So, it's a donut in a burger.
Yeah, a donut in a burger.
It's a burger with bacon and a fried egg served between two glazed donuts.
Oh.
But she now she's got diabetes. She says that she works out on a treadmill. I think she hangs a big Scotch egg and tries to catch it. And I don't know.
They're saying it's actually worse than eating out, but I would have thought people eat more when they're out, especially because one of the Chinese restaurants around the corner from me in Streatham, it's got this thing that says, eat as much as you like. And you just think, well, thank you very much, I will. I won't have you telling me. It would be a bit weird, wouldn't it, if they came up to you and say, all right, put down your knife and fork, fatty, you've had enough. Step away from the buffet.
My mum used to say to me when I was young, Simon, eat your dinner up, there's people starving in Africa. And it's taken me 30 years to realise the correct response. Yes, Mum, people are dying of obesity in the West. Which fate is more likely mine? Take that, Mum.
My gran made us sugar sandwiches. Is that bad?
Yes,
oh, I love a sugar sandwich.
White bread and butter and sugar.
Those were the days, eh?
Now, if that was on MasterChef, they'd call it a deconstructed Victoria sponge. Some of the elements are present.
Are you good at following recipes? You've done lots of cooking programs. Do you follow recipes?
No. I just get dressed in a corset and drink three flagons of wine and pass out. That's my contribution to food programming.
I gave up following chefs' recipes when one of them said, steal half a kilo of cheese from Tesco's and grate. cooking causes more weight gain than eating out because people serve themselves larger portions, according to YouGov survey for Weight Watchers. Eating out can help you lose weight. A late-night kebab may be high in calories, but as soon as the gastroenteritis kicks in, the pounds fall. American celebrity chef Paula Deen, who is famous for recipes full of butter and cream, has announced she has type 2 diabetes and is converting to healthier eating. Deen has been described as the southern belle of butter and heavy cream. Southern because she's from Georgia, and belle because she's the size of Big Ben. A fellow chef described her as the most dangerous person in America. Well, quite. If she falls on you, you've had it. Before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the cuttings. The teams have brought along Mr. Hardy.
This comes from Northampton. I'm going to Northampton next week.
I don't care. Read the thing.
Well, the people of Northampton will care. And I don't know who sent it. It's from the Northampton...
Just stop wittering!
...Chronicle. It says, a serial flasher told a judge he was always an upstanding member of the community.
OK, it was worth waiting. Mr. Munnery.
This is sent in, I think, from Deborah Stevenson, and it comes from the February 1925 edition of the book review journal The Bookman. No authentic manuscripts of Chaucer or Shakespeare are known, but the warrant for the arrest of John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress, is enough to give a thrill to any lover of literature.
Mr. Finnemore.
Well, this was my favourite letter to the editor from the Bournemouth Evening Echo, as it was then when I was growing up. Faith Eckersall missed the point when speaking about live animals for export. I do not like to eat fish in front of the goldfish. And when we had a canary, I swear she got agitated when I ate a boiled egg.
Ms. Perkins.
This was sent in by Neil Tustian, and this is from The Telegraph. A motorist accused of speeding defended himself in court by using rhyming couplets to get his case across. Martin Cassini, 63, a filmmaker from London, admitted driving at 91 miles an hour on the A361 in North Devon. He explained, the outlandish speed was but a short burst on a dual-lane stretch to get up there first, to the top of the hill to avoid getting stuck down the single-lane stretch by a slow-moving truck. Barnstable magistrates fined him £175 and put 6 points on his licence.
Let's take a look at the final score. John and Sue have got 12 points, but this week's winners are Jeremy and Simon with 13. Before we leave you, here is a cutting from Autocross News sent to us by Rob Turville.
An autocross enthusiast has transformed a hearse for competition. We knocked the windows out, he said, and also took out the wooden boxes that were in the back.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the News Quiz Extra were Jeremy Hardy, Simon Munnery, John Finnemore and Sue Perkins. In the chair was Sandy Toksvig, and the news was read by me, Zeb Soames. The chair script was written by Simon Littlefield, Rodri Crooks and Lucy Clark. Additional material by Andy Walton, Robert Gilroy and Jack Bernhardt. The producer was Lindsay Fenner.